This show is brought to you by Safety FM.
What's up, peeps? Welcome back to Rebranding Safety. Today is our last episode of the Quarterly Co-Host with Crystal Danbury. Yeah, I know, I can hear you all crying. Let's jump into the intro and then we'll get right into it.
The problem in safety isn't deviation, it's complexity.
Health and safety has gone mad.
Health and safety is trying to unpick having gone mad in the past.
There's no one solution and one problem. The problem is that we are looking for one solution.
Does the structure of the team allow them to flourish?
Feel safe enough to be uncomfortable.
The environment defines our behaviours.
People aren't the problem, they're the solution.
Rebranding Safety, crushing the stereotype. Brought to you by Risk Fluent. What's up, peeps? Welcome back to Rebranding Safety. Rebranding Safety is the YouTube channel and podcast doing exactly what it says on the tin. So if you're new here, hit that subscribe button and the bell and etc. etc. Today is the last episode of the Quarterly Co-Host with Crystal Danbury, and we're talking about the structure of safety. So we're going to talk about quite a few things, actually: the structure of the safety team, the structure of where safety sits within the organization, and really a lot of things, which is really quite important. We think that maybe structure is just, that's what it is, that's where we sit. Actually, it can have a lot of impact within the organisation. So hope you enjoyed this conversation. Before we get into it, just a quick note from our sponsors. Rebranding Safety is sponsored by Paradigm Human Performance, who are human and organisational performance experts. They've got an amazing team that work all around the world, helping organisations and humans perform better together. If you're looking for high reliability practices, if you're looking for human organisational performance practices, Paradigm Human Performance is the place for you. And if you're not sure, go check out the Learning Organisation webinar on their website as well. Everything's linked in the description below. If you're sold and you want to call them straight away, phone number's below. If you want to email them, email's below as well. Thank you very much, Paradigm, for sponsoring the YouTube channel and podcast. Let's jump into my conversation with Crystal.
Right, Crystal, welcome back. It's your last Quarterly Co-Host.
I know, I'm gutted.
I know, right? I bet you are. And it took us 3 episodes to apparently just sort out all the audio. So apologies to anyone that listens to this. I have no idea what went wrong there. We didn't realise till post-edit that I was like, my wife was editing it. She was like, do you know the audio shit? And I'm like, what, for Crystal? She's like, no, for both of you. I'm like, what? Because mine's set up all perfect. So I don't know what happened there. So apologies for anyone listening on that. But we've upgraded today. Hopefully it's fixed everything.
Amazing.
Crystal, why don't you give yourself an introduction in case anyone hadn't listened to the others, and then summarize what we've covered in the last two, the aim of what we're trying to talk about in all three, and then what we're going to talk about today.
Nice. Okay. So make sure I hit all of those agenda items. So one of them is, I am Crystal Danbury. I am a really passionate 20-year veteran in the safety space, and I have worked across nuclear, rail, logistics, transport, gaming, telecoms and our retail, and all of them really focusing on harm reduction and culture change. I have absolutely loved these three podcasts, and to cover for anyone that's missed the first two, as a collective, we were talking about the cornerstones of safety change. So we've covered in number one, psychological safety and what role that has to play in culture, authenticity and what that has to do with culture and how it leans into that and enables culture change. And then today we will be talking about the safety team, and really sort of jumping into what the traditional safety team looks like, how we think it's evolved, and what we think is really important for the new age of safety in terms of your team makeup. So thank you for joining us. We hope you enjoy.
Awesome. Like a true podcast host, you sounded like there.
You've trained me.
Yeah, much better than me. Okay, I'm going to go in with a hard question straight off the bat.
Go on.
Where should safety sit in the organization?
Oh, God, what a good, hard first question. I think it's really, really difficult. I think one of the things that I would be most against, or one that I would caution against, I would say, is when it sits directly in that operation. If you have a really big organization, I've seen such difficult positions for safety professionals when the operation pays their bills. They have a target and they seem to be part of that really bigger picture for the operation. And when they need to say no or stop, they are seen to be not the team player. Mm. So I think that is really difficult when you're sat when you're sat right in the operational pot, and then saying no is also saying no to your boss who needs their job doing. There needs to be some independence for me. I've seen it sat in a couple of places. The last two roles that I've sat in, it sat under general counsel because they have a complete ability to understand liability, law, risk in a different way. I've seen it sat under assurance before, which is they understand the checking part and the getting out in the field part. That's been quite successful. So I think, I don't really think there's any perfect place, really. I think it's all down to your business culture and where it offers real autonomy. And I think sometimes it's the nature of the boss that it sits under. Yeah. You need to be in to somebody that will sit at the board, no matter what the pressure, and say, this is unsafe and we really shouldn't be doing this. We need somebody that can speak out. So I think you can, you know, you can go into the operation if you want, if you know that that MD or that part of the business has a total ability to call it out at board level, defend the call. Or you can go into a really logical place like legal or assurance or risk. But if the person at the top of that ladder will not sit at board and back you, it's destined for disaster anyway.
I think it is good to like you've added that caveat at the end, and I think that's a good caveat. Like, ultimately, wherever it sits in the organization, you might have made it work, and that's cool. Like, well done you. You know, so there is kind of no one size fits all. I will kind of echo what you've said. In my experience, I've worked for a lot of companies that have had it under operations, and I think that does two things. It creates the conflicts which you've said. And it also communicates to everyone who's not in operations that safety is not important to them because they're not in operations. So I'm like, my kind of scope as my role is a bit weird. If I'm in, or if I'm in operations, did that mean I don't do anything else, like a head office where they're all shared services, for example? So yeah, I think operations is always, I've always struggled with it sitting under operations. Interestingly, in the Safety Sucks book by Sam Goodman, the Hop Nerd, is I think that's such a long name. Like, I feel like if he gets remarried, they should use that full name. Do you, Sam Goodman, the Hop Nerd, take? In his book, he goes in on safety sitting under HR and says it should never be like that because he sees HR as the people that do the disciplining and stuff like that. And fundamentally, if you're trying to be more of a learning, understanding, empathetic safety professional, then if you're in the same department that does the disciplining, you can't do that. And then, well, I think we read that in, that was our first Project Meletium book club, but we read that. So it was a bit before you joined us in the community. And actually there was, it was interesting. There was a bit of a conversation around that where some, you know, disagreed with that and said, I've seen it work. And then some were like, oh, HR of the devil, blah, blah, blah. So it's interesting that ultimately I do think that it can, you can make it work wherever. And it does depend on the leader, I think.
I think the really interesting thing about this is there are, I think, some places that it would be fundamentally, I want to try not to be inflammatory. I think HR would be a bad call, purely because of the like you say, the types of things that they do when you're trying to in culture, when you are trying to navigate open conversation, and you are trying to navigate trust, and you're going to hear things that are not by the book because you need to learn them to create the change. When you are sat, whoever you are sat under, you have to understand that casts a shadow. It casts a shadow of your purpose. It casts a shadow of what the organization consider you to be. And the same organization that handle grievances, disciplinary dismissal, contract negotiation are the same ones that are going to come in and ask you how you really do your job.
Yeah, be honest with us.
Not going to happen, is it? And also, I think the other really interesting thing about your question is, for me, organizations that have safety plugged directly into the CEO that sits on the board, that says something really massive to me, which is the CEO is sat there going, of course you report to me. I want to know what's going on. I want to know who's hurt. Yeah. I want to know what we're doing wrong, what we're doing right. And I want to know how we're improving it. So I think there's wherever you plug that in, A, you need to be open to standing behind your safety person 100% regardless of the cost. And backing up the argument, because the business could always make their own decision, but backing that argument, but also wherever you plug it in casts a shadow of how your safety people will be perceived and how important you think safety is. Can you imagine if you employed a director of safety and they said, right, you're going to plug into, you're going to plug into sort of an area manager. The way that you get a message to the board is there's like seven rungs of management all the way up. So you've got lots of things to go. Well, is that what you think looking after your people is? That I have to go through seven? Where is my most direct line to tell you how important A, this remit is, but B, who's hurt and how we're going to make that better? I think where you plug it in and what level you plug it in tells a lot about your organization's view of safety.
Yeah. And it'd be those same organizations that have to go through 10 to 15 rungs of management level to get to the board that say safety is our first priority, which is all.
Oh, yeah. Bullshit. Yeah, absolutely. But you already know, right? Yeah. You could go into an organization and say, hey, where's your safety team? And then you could ask a couple of questions, right? Where do you plug in? Mm. What level do you plug in at? And how often do you get a message to the board? Probably tells you quite a lot already.
Tell you everything you need to know. Yeah. Was actually going to be my next question. Should we report directly into the CEO, which I think you've already nailed. And I think if you're, I don't necessarily, I'm not overly against it not being a safety role, like a health and safety director on the board. But I do think it needs to have a direct connection to the board.
Yeah.
How if you're a big massive company, I quite like the idea of having like a risk department that kind of manages those all aspects of risk, that very much my way of thinking, and I think that works for me. It might not work for everybody, but for me, I think safety and health is just one aspect of risk. I think you've got corporate social responsibility, you consider data, bribery, all of those things that are all risk, and I think they're very unique risks. And I think this model only obviously applies really to a big organization. I think the mindset applies to a smaller organization, but the structure obviously only applies to a big organization. If you've got that kind of that level of, you've got a mixed bag of like specialists and generalists within that risk organization, I see that only as a benefit really for me. And then I think a board would be more, a board wouldn't be so reactive if you said, can we create a director of risk, as they might be if you said, can we create a director of safety? Because I think that doesn't have less of a perception, a preconception to it, and that people are like, oh, health and safety, you're on the board. Just going to have this goody two shoes on the board. But if we had a director of risk that could look at this a bit more holistically, then maybe
holistically. Yeah,
they're a bit more inclined to say, yeah, actually, I would welcome a person like that on the board. That's kind of my mindset.
That feels like the evolution, I think, as well, to be really looking at this as a risk to the business, along with all your other legal, business, CSR, environment, all these other things that are a risk. I think that's a wonderful evolution. And I think the time with the board thing's really interesting. I know from having managed quite big teams that you don't have time for everyone to plug into you. Mm. It doesn't mean you don't care about the output, but it is about the exposure to their output and how often you make room for that. And I think the really lovely thing about where I am now is what do they call it? My boss, who works for the CEO, has a one-to-one, but it's a group one-to-one. So all his DRs go in and we have like a 6-to-1. Mm. And the first thing that was on his mind is, tell me what's going on in the safety space. You've been here X amount of months, what's going on? And I just think, great. PLC board paper that goes in that's got safety all over it. I am the one that presents that message with the right-hand man, which is my boss. And I just think, I don't plug directly into the board, plug directly into the CEO, but they're making time for the exposure. They're making time for the message.
So it can work.
For sure. But I love that. I've actually posed that a couple of times at different places about that holistic risk piece, because it is just risk to people. You've got risk to people, risk to business, risk to finance, risk to environment. Mm. pull it together, have one major amazing direction on that piece, and drive reduction across the lot. I mean, that's kind of the sort of, there's two jobs that I think would be the most perfect jobs in the world for me. And that is like chief risk officer, looking at all of that, or chief ethical officer. So just looking after everything ethics, which is like D&I, safety, harm, environment, all that stuff. But I think still bringing those risk pieces together. So I'm 100% with you.
How beautiful would a board be if it is like chief executive officer, chief operating officer, chief financial officer, chief ethical officer or ethics officer? That would be beautiful.
It's my dream. That's my dream job. I've made it up. It doesn't exist.
I think that should be in every serious brand. Like chief ethics officer, like, yeah, that's beautiful. And then chief risk officer, fucking love that. Love that.
Yeah.
You know, head of HR probably sits on there as well. I don't know what you call them, chief people officer. I'm not sure. I'm not a fan of calling HR people, like the head of people, because I think that it seems like again, this feels like I'm tarring HR with a brush, and I've never worked in HR, and I've worked with some amazing HR professionals. I work very closely now with a HR professional that gets it. Like she's so good. But ultimately, her job also includes that disciplinary side of things. So I'm like, if you're going to call me chief people officer and I'm actually head of HR, I feel like you're still just putting glitter on a turd. Like I've still got to do those really nasty. I've still got to do those really nasty jobs. You know what I mean?
Yeah. But do you know what? So like do we. Me. Can you imagine all the discovery that we have to go through, even if you use things like the fairness decision trees? When we do a proper investigation where something's really gone wrong, sometimes that can be a really icky piece of work. There is some serious accountable things that we need to be accountable for, people need to take accountability for. I think there's not one part of the business that doesn't have to deliver a crappy message, that some people have bigger connotations. But chief, that's my dream job. One day I will work for an organization and say, I love all this stuff. And that's the, you know, hire for will, not for skill, right? I can do safety blindfolded. I've done it for a very long time. I bloody love it. I love people. That's why I love safety. And that's the reason why I love that whole ethics piece. So, I mean, that's a job that I swear to God, one day I will create for myself, chief ethical officer.
I could see brands going for that, you know, like a company like Netflix. I reckon they'd snap that up.
Yeah.
You read their
coined here first. Right up
there. Yeah, there you go. I'll let Ruth know.
Let Ruth know.
Chris was looking for a job. All right, what's she looking for? No, sorry, I said that wrong. She designed her own job.
I've designed my own job, for sure.
Okay, so we've started at the top, right? We've established that it should be connected to the board, ideally. Then how are you seeing the structure of the team as we go down the levels now then?
I think the really interesting thing I wanted to dive into here is we're coming from an era where we used to stamp diploma or certificate on every single job description. We'd put it out. We get the real traditionalists in and all the technical experts, right? People that were really technical. They could do all these, you know, use the Mac tool that was so complicated. It blows my brains out.
I avoid the Mac tool like a fucking
plague. Who doesn't? I don't know a single person that's like, do you know my favorite tool ever? It's the Mac tool.
I've come across this guy once who was like, yeah, I like all six tools. Or I think there's five actually. There's the Art tool, the Mac tool. And there's like three or four others. And it was like, yeah, this is for this. And I'm like, dude, you are that guy, aren't you? Like, you love that shit.
He's that technical person, right? Yes. And this is the bit that I think is crazy. Is we used to say everyone had to be a generalist, and then very occasionally we'd pick a specialist depending on what sector we worked in.
Yeah.
I think we are really changing that vibe. And I think really, essentially, we really need to. That now I would much prefer to have people-centric, care-focused individuals taking up the leadership parts of my team. So people that actually care about people, people that really want to make the difference. Yeah. And where you've got key risks in your risk profile, hire your technical expert. But if you have a whole house that's just full of dry, paper-driven, compliance-driven individuals, what you will get is compliance. You will not get safety. And it's, they are fundamentally different things. Compliance will drive you to the halfway mark, right? Culture wise, you'll get some people that will create really good muscle memory out of compliance. Some of them are very good with a process or procedure. You tell me one person that's at the sharp end of a risk that before they climb the pole, dig the hole, rip the floor up. They go, tell you what, let me get the SOP out. Let me just have a little read to make sure I've really reread the risk assessment today. And I really know what my controls are. And
wait,
just
what? Double check. Workers don't do that? What?
Right? Because guess what?
Oh, shit.
They have a day job and they have time pressure and they have deliverables. You have to have people that are people-centric because what you will deliver is paper.
Yeah. For me, I think if you've got that kind of, and I think the profession needs to redesign themselves, not just we're talking about a big company that's got a lot of resource and we're talking high level. And obviously maybe we'll talk later about what that looks like in a smaller company. But ultimately, I do think you need generalists are powerful people. Like, everyone says what's that saying?
Jack of all trades, master of none.
Jack of all trades, master of none, right? And people stop the saying there.
Yeah.
But actually, the proper saying, the original quote continues on, and it says, Jack of all trades, master of none, but often better than master of one.
Very cool.
So I never knew that until maybe about 6 months ago. And I was just like, what the fuck? Like my whole life. And that was nuts. And then I remember posing the conversation I did a video on this a while back. I think I called it something quite provocative around why the safety profession is doomed or whatever. And then David Provan commented on it being don't devalue generalists. Generalists bring a really, really powerful tool and a mindset and approach to the organization. And I was like, yeah, shit, that's a really good point. So for me, I've started to imagine, and again, a lot of this has stemmed from also a conversation with Dr. Rob Long. And if you think I'm provocative, you need to read some of his blogs he is mega provocative, right? But ultimately he says, we're not a profession. So he says, all safety professionals, you're not a professional, right? Which gets my back up because I'm working class. I was never going to be a professional in my entire life. And I've worked fucking hard to become myself a professional. Right. Yeah. So I'm like, piss
Amen
off, mate.
To that. Yeah.
I'm like, piss off, mate. I've worked really hard to be a professional. I'm going to call myself one. But when I interviewed him and I challenged him on it, his point was when I think about a profession, I think about the healthcare industry. And we were talking, and he said about legal and loads of other stuff. So I then, after a very long conversation, I put the conversation back to him and I said the question back to him and said, okay, let's say, for example, the safety profession or the risk management profession, as I would prefer to call it, was set up like this. You had general practitioners, GP, same as we do in NHS, right?
Yeah.
Their job is they've got a little bit of an understanding of the kind of people side of it. They've got a good understanding of the systems kind of side of things, good understanding of the technical side of things, and then a good understanding of the compliance side of things. So across the board, they've got a good understanding of all kind of what I would think are the kind of key components of risk management, right?
Yep.
So people, systems, technical compliance.
Yep.
General practitioner. Their job is to go in, identify issues or problems, try and solve them like your GP does, try this drug and then go away. Did the drug work? No, it didn't. Okay, let's try this.
Escalate to your specialist.
Didn't work. Now I'm going to refer you, right?
Yep.
So I see a big company, you have a risk department, and they have the front line of GPs, general practitioners, general risk practitioners, whatever you call them. Behind them, I see teams of specialists. I see human performance specialists, people that can really understand human performance and how a company and behaviors work together and what that looks like. Kind of systems as in what I would kind of think of resilience and looking at it from a organizational resilience point of view. And then I'd look at technical geniuses, basically technical geeks. So
yeah. You need those.
Yeah, definitely. You 100% need them. So you need people that And it, this depends on your wrist. Like, you're not going to have a technical geek for everything. But if you're like, if your top five wrists are working at high confined space, and I don't know, maybe you do chemicals and stuff, like, you're going to have some.
Then have those techs there for sure.
Exactly. Yep. Right. So they're going to be a proper, probably going to be like a much smaller team. These teams are small teams, but they're specialists, like all of them.
Yeah.
And then I see you have your compliance experts. So these are people that nail, they're like in the law. They know the law inside out. Those really annoying people that I don't get on with very well at all. They're just like, the Health Technical Work Act was written in 1974 and section 1.2, like those people, because you need them. And then they get ISO 45001. They love it. They're in it. They get it. All that system types of accreditation and approval stuff.
That's you're clocking I think you're clocking the exact same. So even at the beginning, when I was just like, have a whole bunch of people focus, you have to have competence, right? I wouldn't, very rarely would I bring somebody in, and I have done in one of my previous roles, that hasn't got any formal qualifications, but it just is excellent in that, say, you know, didn't even know they were working in safety beforehand, but they bloody were. Shout out to Lee, if you're listening. But that generalist, that top level lot of experts that look at the whole shebang, and the technical people underneath aligned to your risk profile, the thing that you've nailed there is a whole load of people that love what they do, that they're into it.
Yeah, exactly.
And I think the worst teams,
and their personalities fit with it as well.
Absolutely. So, you know, one of the best people that I ever saw working with standards is somebody that just geeked out hard about the standard. And oh my God, every, you know, could tell you every subsection, everything of the standards. Exactly. Yeah. The worst person I've ever seen work with standards is somebody that was made to do it because someone was made redundant. And did they ever keep their accreditations? Did they help? It was always firefighting because they hated it. And I had the same with data. You get somebody and you employ them. They're a sort of generalist, but you're shoehorning them into a technical area. Yeah. It never goes well. I'd done the best thing I've ever done, because I think you can't do safety without having really, really good data people, right? I am safety 1, 2 and differently, and all of them mixed together is all of them. And I put a job out for a data person, right? And had loads of people come and interview. And what I did is I took a big cleanse, a big sweep or scrape, as they call it, of data, and I gave it to the people at their interview and said, I know that there's trends in this data. I'm going to give you an hour. I'm going to come back, find whatever you can, right? They knew what was in the data, what they were looking at, what the heading was. Totally bored people that were very good, halfway through, knock on the door. Can I just go? This is quite, you know, I've done it and I don't really, yeah, fine. You know, they have it obviously not interested in what they can do quite naturally.
So pull that back up, Crystal, just a bit.
Sorry.
That's all right.
Obviously not interested in what they can do. And do you know who got the job? There was a young guy, James, who is still the best person I've ever known. Legend of James.
Legend.
He didn't quite finish the task. Right. But what he did when we walked in was still, oh my God, he was still finding stuff, because as he was talking, he couldn't help but be drilling the data in real. And even though he's in the interview, like, yeah, no, and I found this and this age profile and this is, oh, but have you seen? And he was just there rediscovering in front of us. And me and who I was interviewing with, Joe, we looked at each other and he's still going, oh, and did you see? And I was like, yeah, okay, this is, he barely got to the lift before we were like, do you want to just tell him now, or do we wait the official 24 hours?
Love that.
Because he loves what he does. You don't have to be the quickest, cleanest person at what you do. If you love it, all the rest can be coached. But you have to be into it. And this is where you get your specialists, right? People that work in ergonomics or CAM or whatever. If I'm ever interviewing or going for tender, by the way, so even if I'm working with a third party, if I get a standard pitch by a third party, not interested at all. If you are talking and going off on tangents because each facet is so interesting to you, I'm listening big time, because the number one thing you have to have is passion.
Passion.
And whether that's a passion for being a generalist, I'm a generalist, right? I've worked across all sectors. I would say if you were going to say I was a specialist in anything, it would be people. Mm. Can't get more like general than people. But I am geek-tastically into people and behavior and why. And I'm absolutely obsessed with everyone having the right to go home.
Yeah.
That's it. That's why I do what I do. and you go out and you get those technicals. And so I'm with you. You generalist, your GPs, and then you refer to your specialists, wherever your specialists, if you can't fix it. So I'm with you, definitely.
And that's the problem. Go on, carry on.
And I was just going to say, so where are you in terms of your, for me, we're going from compliance safety and, you know, sort of 10 years ago it was, and before, massively all compliance driven. We're now getting to understand that people have their own thoughts and they have bad days and behavior is a thing. Yeah. And also so is unhappiness and fatigue and work pressure. And for me, I just think this is the really big shift of this decade about moving people's thought process to, just because you've got the paper doesn't mean you've fixed anything. In fact, you haven't, you've just documented a problem. Mm. And so the big change in teams now, and what you really need in a team is people-focused passion, and everything well beyond compliance.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely, 100%. And the profession as a whole needs to understand this and take it up. I want to see the membership organizations turn around and say, actually, we acknowledge that there's a difference between a generalist and a specialist, and we need both. And at the moment, mm-hmm. we're just selling everyone's a generalist. Everyone's a generalist. And I remember doing my NTRQ not that long ago, like a year ago, and I was stubborn and said, I ain't doing that. That I know what I'm talking about. Don't need no fucking badge to tell me I'm so. And then I realized, shit, no one's going to interview me.
No.
I know, right? Yeah. They realized, shit, no one's interviewing me because I haven't got that badge. Quick, get the credit card. So do the NTRQ. And I'm going through the last section. Don't get me wrong. I don't think any. So here's my kind of bias. I have a bias when talking about the qualifications because I don't think any of our existing qualifications are fit for purpose at the moment as they are. However, I will say that I have relished the change in styles that we've seen of late with NTRQ coming out and then forcing NEBOSH to kind of re-examine where they are, and then COVID forcing them even more to re-examine how they do it. So I've relished that. That's nice to see. So in that context, I do think NCRQ is a very good qualification. However, it's still delivered more of the same, which we didn't need, in my opinion. Anyway, off my soapbox now. I remember doing number one, which is like the basic stuff. Book two, which was like all civil law. Like it was all like civil law and precedents and case studies and stuff. And I fucking hate law, right? But I actually loved that middle book. Like it was wicked. I really loved going through all these case studies. And I was like, this is interesting AF. Right. So I'm like, shit, maybe I am a generalist. Like in this process, I thought, maybe if I just did, like, don't get me wrong, I love the human performance stuff, right? I love the behavioral stuff. And I was in on that. And I was like, once I've done the NCRQ, I'm going to get myself up to, like, you know, a good, like a master's in HP or a master's in behavioral economics or something like that. And that's where I'm going to get to and just specialize. And then in that process, I was like, oh, maybe I don't want to specialize actually, because I love this stuff. But then I get to the third book, right? And it's like it's called Further Hazards or whatever, I can't remember, right? And it's basically a couple of pages, and depending on the risk of the type of risk and how risky that is, you get more pages or less pages. And I'm going through it, and bear in mind, I'd actually specialized prior to this in fire safety for a fair chunk of time in the NHS and housing. So I'd actually become a bit of a fire geek. And I got to the last bit and they did like 4 or 5 pages on fire. And I'm like, nowhere near enough. Nowhere near enough. Like, I'm like, did nobody watch the news like 4 or 5 years ago when I was doing this? Like, this shit kills people. It was nowhere near enough. And I'm like, okay, now we've got a problem. Because we're trying to give people this generalist overview of stuff that kills people, and it's not enough. And there's no expertise behind them to support them. So, and that's where the issue is. So if I was doing the NTRQ, but I knew that I could go and employ a fire consultant, a fire engineer tomorrow, which you can for fire, right? I can get a specialist, I'm fine. So it's a little bit like, yeah, okay, but how many people know that you can actually go and employ a proper fire consultant? I probably think not too many. And then I think as you start to go through all the other stuff, it gets less and less. So you're starting to see more ergonomic specialists from a DSE point of view and working in the office. That's nice to see. But if you go and type in like health and safety consultant specialist working at height, you just get general consultant.
Yeah, of course you do.
And I'm really struggling of late, actually recently, to find a specialist working at height specialist, like a real specialist in working at height. Whenever I do find them, then they're normally like they're closely related to the product. So they know the product and stuff. But I want someone that can actually help me help our members manage working at height as a holistic kind of risk. So I'm not kind of supporting. And maybe someone's listening to this, maybe like, what are you on about? There's loads of specialist consultants, but not as rife as what we need them to be. There's not enough of them. Do you know what I mean? Like it should just be known. Like, you know, you go on LinkedIn and you're like, oh yeah, I know at least 6 working at height specialists, 4 chemical specialists, 4 DSE ergonomic specialists, 5 this, 5 that. And you could just go on, because that's how the industry is. I guarantee the fucking GP could turn around and go, yeah, I'll tell you about 6 people that can give you an x-ray, 4 people that can replace your leg, 5 people that can cure cancer. They'll know, because they work with them every day. We don't have that. And I think that's a massive gap.
I always thought it was quite interesting that there was never any, years and years ago, IOSH brought out the register, didn't they? Like the approved register for consultants or whatever. Mm. And I thought that was going to be the answer. I thought that was going to be like the Bible. If you're running a team and you need a specialism and you don't have it naturally in your team, especially if it's a newly arising one that you're not anticipating it being a solid part of your risk profile going forward, you need somebody in the minute to come and help you. Yep. I really thought that was going to be it, but
like
there is
a virus expert.
Yeah, like,
you know, we needed them about a year ago, didn't we? 2 years ago.
Yep, absolutely. So I do think that we could definitely do better at making centralizing a really good solid list of competent specialists. I think the whole comment about NCRQ. I will just, something that you said that resonated massively with me, which is, I come from working class background. I got sort of standard or slightly below standard grades at school, and I went straight to work as a cleaner in Domino's Pizza. The fact that however many years later I was then studying the law section of the NEBOSH diploma and loving it, I thought was both my favorite moment in life, really, pre-Emily, was like, I'm actually studying law, and this is amazing. But I think what makes it amazing is both you and I weren't, from what I know of you, weren't doing it to I was doing it because I needed it to, that's what's expected of a safety professional. But this is what's expected. You're expected to have a diploma or now the NCRQ. I did mine like 10 years ago before the NCRQ was a real thing. And the reason that made so much sense to me is because it put life in legislation for me. Like learning the case law, learning all the stuff that sits behind the dry pieces of legislation. I don't really talk to people about legislation. I talk to people about cases. Did you know? Yeah. And if someone mentions a piece of legislation, I try
that's perfect.
To talk to
where
them.
You got it,
yeah, lovely. Thank you. I try to talk to them about the case law, the person that had to die or be mauled to create that. I have that conversation, which is, oh God, this piece of legislation is so boring. And I always say this, do you know how many people have to die before we change the law? And everyone's like, what? It's like, well, if one person died of one type of accident, people will go, that's a tragedy. Two people die over a couple of years of that one, it's a tragedy. Do you know how many people have to die for us to design a white paper, to send it through the House, to do all that sort of stuff and create a piece of legislation? When you see this book with this year on and all the work behind it, know plenty of people had their life changed to have this book here. Yeah. And it's a different thing for me. I loved the law because I loved learning how it got there, what was the process? And when I read it, for me, it's about protecting. This piece of legislation protects people, and it gives me a tool to talk to the organization about protecting. You know, we are benefiting from people that have lost their lives. We're benefiting from a judge seeing this time and time again and saying, screw this. This is not happening anymore. We're now going to make it illegal to do this. That's how big a deal this is. That's how big a deal this risk is. So actually, you know, I'm here to bring that message home. But mine is, as usual, even in legislation, it's people-centric. How many people have to die before you change the law? So I think it's magic. I actually trained to deliver NEBOSH training. I don't know if you know this. Because it was being delivered in an inhumane way. It was being delivered. We were being trained to pass exams. Yeah. The diploma, you cannot do that. Back in the day, there was no such thing as open book. You had to just know it verbatim. But even the way all that was delivered, it was so non-human centric. And yet the profession is meant to be there for people. Yeah. So I literally went, while pregnant, the whole 9 months I was pregnant, I went to college at the weekends, worked like full-time job and weekend studied to be a teacher. Or like an adult learning teacher, so that one day I could teach adults not just the diploma, not just how to pass an exam, but what it means. Because I'm with you, it missed something. Like the information I found amazing and I love the study, but there's something missing, something about people that's missing.
Well, I also think that what's missing from, like, we've got that the gap in the profession, I think, but also what's missing in the actual way that we train safety professionals is that facilitation skill. Like it's kind of maybe less so now, but definitely when I did my NEBOSH general, because I remember thinking it, that I knew better because I'd been on a 2-week course. I know better than Bob the welder. Do you know what I mean? Even though Bob the welder has been welding for like 20 years and I've done a 2-week course and I think I know better. So what I think we do miss even now, like, you know, everyone's fucking talking about it. And no matter what webinar I go on or keynotes, you know, recruiters, everyone's talking about it. Soft skills are so important. Soft skills, this, soft skills. And it always comes with a shitty, annoying caveat that, like, don't get me wrong, technical skills are really important. Yes, they are. I'm not fucking saying that. Because we're doing the technical skills. We don't have to talk about that because we're doing it, right? Yeah. So just leave them for a moment. I don't want to hear your shitty caveat. What are you doing to enable people to have the soft skills? Because at the moment, I'm going to employ someone with a NEBOSH general and I'm going to have to coach them with the soft skills. So they can't get going straight away. They've only got those technical skills. Then someone might go, you can't teach soft skills. You can't see. No, maybe you can't. But what you can do is you can put in a book the power of kind of empathy, the power of appreciative inquiry, and what you can benefit from that. So why coming at this from a I know better point of view doesn't work.
Yeah.
And that's a big letdown. And I think even though you've got IOSH and the like, I put it in their framework, but it's like, but what are you creating to actually give people that? What are you doing to actually tell people that this is really important? And you're not going to do a good job until you do that, until you have that.
No, absolutely. Do you know what? While you were talking, I was thinking about the topic of team and the safety team. I was thinking about Bob the welder and that he's part of the safety team. Mm. Every single person, I've never been out ever with an engineer in 19 years and them say, what am I trying to say? The person that knows that job better than anyone and the risks entrenched in that job is Bob the welder, is the engineer climbing the pole, right?
Yep.
And actually, the best thing I ever did in terms of a safety campaign was nick Simon Sinek's One by One Policing and turn it into a safety campaign in my last job. And I put on social media internally, today is One by One Safety Day, right? And we only have to change one thing just today, and we would have changed 40,000 things. What's your one by one safety thing? Because you already do it, and I know you do. The we had 5,000 posts. Some of them were videos of multiple people in that team. So we're talking probably 7,000-8,000 people involved in one-by-one safety, right? All telling me what they already do. They didn't need me out there telling them. I don't know how to weld. I don't know how to climb a pole. I don't know how to rip a pole out of the floor or dig a hole, right? Give it a good go. But I'm not the expert. They told me how they keep their job safe. They told me your safety team is a small bubble of people that are supposed to really appreciate what is going on in real time. Mm. And as stuff starts to go wrong, we're supposed to catch it. We're supposed to dig in and understand it. And we're supposed to help fix it so everybody gets home.
Yeah.
We are not a bubble of people to tell an organization what to do. We are there to understand and help resolve.
Yeah.
Now, I don't know about you, but any team that's geared up to do that reactively, so stuff's already gone wrong, is on a hiding to nothing. Mm-hmm. And a team that is already sitting there with a whole bunch of people that say, I know best, and I'm just going to tell you, you know, I'll write my report and send that out and let you know what's happening, but nothing's, there's no resolve at the end. What are you doing?
Mm.
It's just wasting paper.
Yeah.
Don't tell me what's happening. Tell me what's going to happen. Get in front of it.
And I think we fell down so much when we started seeing the safety profession as the safety experts. Like the second we do that, like I think everyone's like, oh yeah, this is James on our call as a safety expert. And I'm like, no, I mean, don't get me wrong, I don't interrupt them every time. Normally I just roll my eyes, but if it's suitable, I will say I'm not an expert. Because I think that when we talk about deference to expertise and high reliability organizations talk about that a lot, deference to expertise, that expertise is the front line. They're the experts.
Yes.
It's my job to facilitate that expertise. And that expertise might also be an actual expert, as in a consultant geek who's a fucking right on expert for that thing. It could also be talking to a lawyer. Right, but my job as a generalist is to interpret the legislation, interpret what the HSE or anyone else might say as this is potentially best practice, and then talk to the expert, the doer of the job, and say, what do we think? The law says this, are we doing it? The best practice says to do this, are we doing it? Could we do this better? What do you think?
Yeah. That's what? 100%. And I think, there was a time, there was something that happened when I was studying. And at the time, I felt really embarrassed, right? And then I realized when you've been doing it for a very long time, this is exactly how you're meant to feel. I was studying my diploma and I'd been studying specific hazards or whatever it was. And I'd been doing a bit on, to touch around the edges on asbestos.
Right.
Now, my dad is an electrical engineer,
yeah.
Right? He's in boiler rooms every single day, dealing with asbestos every single day. And he went, right, girly, go on then, all the different types of asbestos, how dangerous they are, what's the worst one, how do you protect, like, go on, you know, impress me. And I was like, and then everything, A, went out of my head because I've been put on the spot, but B, I thought, huh, you're an expert. Now, it doesn't say asbestos safety expert, does it? No, he's an electrical engineer, but he works that stuff all day. Mm-hmm. And then I said to him, Pops, I've gone, other than being able, literally, this is, I was like, chrysotile, and it just, that's the only thing I could come up with. And he was like, oh, anyway, he then runs through all this stuff.
Yeah,
he knows. He told me the hazard, he told me how severe the consequence was, he told me the control, he told me everything. Is there safety anywhere in that man's title? Nah. Did he know that risk backwards? Of course he did, because he is the expert, to your point.
Exactly. So let's try and bring this back to structure, because we both went down a little rabbit hole there ranting about the profession.
I think we've been touching it. Safety team. I think what we've been doing is really opening this up to the fact that don't be arrogant and think that your bubble in the middle that has the safety title is your safety team, right? Every single member of your organization casts a shadow, holds a responsibility for safety.
Yeah.
You as an organization are a team of people doing safety. Mm. In terms of your technical experts in the center, the people that are there to see and get in front of trends when you can't, when you're that close to the risk, is us. And in terms of structure, I think we discussed, where do we think we should plug in?
Yep.
And I think operation is a mistake. HR is a mistake. But those sort of other risk-based pockets of activity in the organization, fine.
Good work.
The most important thing really is that the person sat at the top of that tree has the ability to stand forth in really tricky situations and say the truth. Mm. That's the main thing for me. And then in terms of structure, I'm with you. I think competence is really important, and I'm going to have to be really real. If you put a CV on my desk, I'm going to think about what you've done before now. I'm going to think about your competency. And that's really important for a generalist, right? For that top tier, what's going on? I've been around the block a few times. I can see risk coming. I can see a trend. I know how to find stuff. I get out. Characteristics of those people and that structure is different. I get out and about. I know the importance of proactive investigating work, all that, great. And then my risk profile. What are your key risks in your organizations? Do you have foundries, right? Do you have massive vehicles that go and yank poles out of the floor? Do you have massive cutting machines? You should probably have technical experts aligned to your risks, but also the trends that are going massively off piece. If you've got a problem in road, you should probably have a road risk person sat on your team dedicated to that. So I'm with you. It almost works like the medical profession. It's a care profession, right? We'll take care of it with general advice and general guidance. And then where we're having real problems, we'll get the experts in.
That is exactly what Rob says. Dr. Rob Long says it's a care profession.
It is.
And I didn't mention that. So it's funny that you both came to the same conclusion without.
Well, I said a long time ago, I'd love to be the director of care because that's genuinely what I feel I do. And then my friend who works in social care was like, well, you have heads of care that work with in the sort of children, social housing sector and stuff that are called care. So it would be confusing.
Yeah,
but if you ever ask me what I do, I take care of people. That's me. But yeah, we are a care profession. And I think sometimes we forget that. We can be compliance if you drive us there. But what we really are and what we really should be is the sort of heartbeat of the organization in terms of caring for everybody.
One last thing I think it would be good to spend a couple of minutes on. Yep. Assuming that you don't have those specialists and you're going for the bog standard safety team, e.g.
Yep.
head of safety, mm-hmm. maybe a manager, and then a load of people. What are you calling your safety team? What are their names? And does it matter? So like business partners, coach, advisors, officers, whatever. What are you calling them?
I wouldn't even think about what they were called. I would think about if you've literally got in your budget a starting a new organization, small organization, a small pocket of cash, and you think, I know I need safety people, I would say one thing. You need a strategist. 100% to head up that function. Not somebody that's just concentrating on the specific risk, but somebody that's going to take you forward and change your organization. Mm. So you need a safety strategist at the top. And then underneath that, and it doesn't matter how you structure it as far as I'm concerned, you need a couple of things. You need 100% the reactive view, right? So somebody that's going to go out, that's going to chunk that data down, go find it, is massively interested. You need someone to resolve what they find. Right. So what's your change group? What's your action group? And then you need somebody that's proactive. So that could be your assurance, right? Whatever that is, go out, proactive investigation, typical assurance, audit, whatever you want to call it. You need proactive, reactive, proactive, reactive, and resolve. They're the three things you need to make sure happen in your team. And you can call them whatever you want, and they can have whatever specialism wrapped into that. But are you looking reactively and taking care of that and learning? Are you dealing with it proactively and getting out in front of your work and seeing what comes and looking out to other organizations? And are you resolving what you find? That would be me.
I like that. So for you, it doesn't matter if you call it like safety officer, not bothered.
No, safety coach. I mean, there's some really great things, safety officer, safety coach, safety leader. Lots of people do different things. My thing is no. And actually it's dictated by essentially the DNA of your organization. If you're working in an industry that is fairly command and control, they might react to certain titles better. Because also you need to make sure those people can communicate on a level with the people they have to. So the job title should just be appropriate for your culture and the type of industry that you're in.
Yeah.
The main thing is what they're doing.
Yeah, exactly. And that was going to be what's going to finish on there. Like, I have worked for an organization where I've been called a business partner, and a business partner for me would be a more forward thinking title. It implies that you're partnering the business and helping them. You're more of a facilitator, not an officer, which to me implies command and control. Right.
Yeah.
Interestingly, the job was right up there in officer, because that was the culture of how they approached safety. Like, it was so, we were called business partners, but we weren't. We were auditors. That's what we were. Yeah. We were auditors. We didn't really do any business partnering whatsoever. We only went to site to audit them. It was fucking horrible, if I'm honest. But it was, it was just, it wasn't that. So ultimately, I am not a fan of calling them officers, if I'm honest. However, it's funny that I'm not a fan of calling them officers on the shop floor, but I've kind of just fine with the board being called officers, even though it's the same word. So yeah. I've kind of got a bias there, obviously, that I haven't really worked out. I've only just kind of realized that in this conversation, which is strange.
Yeah.
But like, I'm kind of now sitting here reflecting on why am I okay with officer being on the board, but not on the floor? Is it because they're the direct connection to the workforce or what? I'm really not sure. But ultimately, it really doesn't matter. If I'm the safety officer, that might give me an indication that the company is a bit more command and control. But if I'm there and the guy or girl is not that way inclined, man, I don't give a crap what you're called.
Yeah, amen.
I really don't. I'm not against advisor. I quite like the title advisor. I thought it worked. Like, I'm the safety advisor. I come here to give you safety advice. I think that works quite well.
Yeah. I mean, if you really had time on your hands and you were building it from scratch, the beautiful thing is you could go out to your workforce and say, this is the purpose of the role, right? We are here to look after you. What do you think the role should be called?
Yeah. And I get that, like, words create worlds and stuff like that. And I understand that. But, like, I'm also a bit like, picture paints a thousand words. Do you know what I mean? Like, your actions speak louder than words. And I just think, like, you can call me an officer all you like, but like, if I go into shop floor and I'm partnering with them, my title doesn't matter. I don't know. Maybe it does. Maybe it doesn't. But yeah,
if it's going really well, you'll never ever think about the title anyway. Someone will be able to walk into an office and say, James, I've got an issue. Do you want to come have a look?
Exactly. But I do think the most important thing, which really, we covered this actually really, really comprehensively in, we didn't cover it comprehensively. We questioned it a few times. In the first quarterly co-host, we had Laura, and me and Laura kind of jointly interviewed a load of business leaders. They were not safety professionals. They were like CEOs and MDs and stuff like that. And I asked them all roughly the same question. Why is safety struggling to get on the board? Like, what do we need to do to be on the board? And kind of didn't really get a good answer out of most of them. And I think one of them had it in reporting into the top of the organization. And ironically, it was a trade association. And the first time I have ever been in a role where safety is reported direct into the top of the organization is my role right now at a trade association. So I thought, how weird is that? That's very strange. How funny is
that? What does that say about the culture of trade organizations? That's interesting.
That is interesting. Yeah. Because it is. And I've only just realized that as well. But ultimately, I think, Crystal, that is the most important thing. Some form of risk management that's connected to safety, be that head of safety, head of risk, whatever. I think that safety needs to have a direct connection to the top of the organization.
Absolutely. Of course it does. Yeah. That's a couple we said at the beginning, didn't we? That's it casts where you plug it in and who you have sat there casts the shadow about how you value it. So 100%.
Yeah. I think that is the most important thing for me. And interestingly, it's a shame that we didn't get onto this, and we're going to run out of time because unfortunately I'm back to back today, but it's interesting that in his book, culture, Carsten actually says a lot of the time, structure is what we're talking about when we talk about culture, and that the structure of an organization is kind of like a big factor within the organization's culture, which I've never really thought about before. But like, it is, when you think about it, you're like, yeah, it does. And we've kind of touched on that today. Like, the culture and the impact of the safety team might be affected as to where they report into.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, it's interesting.
Amazing.
Well, Crystal, I've had a really good chat with you these last three episodes. We've both been really busy, so we tried to cram these in. So they're probably some of the shorter episodes I've ever done, which is a shame because I could talk to you forever. But thank you very much for coming on. Do you want to give a shout out to your podcast still going? You still doing your podcast?
Yes, I did a couple of episodes and I need to get back on it, actually. Somebody gave me some... So I've got a podcast on Anchor called Why Should I Care? And then just going through sort of typical work-related or ethical things, just discussing whether we should care about them at all or whether we're made to care about them. And then if they want to see more about me in general, I've got a website, www.crystaldanbury.co.uk.
I did not know that.
There you go.
Checking that out. Links to that will be in the description, that's for sure.
So, but yeah, that's me in a nutshell. But if anyone ever wants to get hold of me, as I said on the last couple, LinkedIn is a really good place. I'm quite active on there.
And they can talk to you every Wednesday or Friday at Project Meletium, can't they,
Crystal? Of course they can. Course I they wax can. Lyrical about Project Meletium. So 100%, if you want a really forward-thinking organisation or community, I call it a safety community, to join, yeah, troubleshoot, see how we feel, really progress things and to change your mind or alter your mind or progress your thinking in safety, then Project Meletium is the place.
I don't even need to do the advert at the end of the episode now. Thank you very much, Crystal.
Thank you very much. And lovely to join you, James. Thanks for the time.
Okay, peeps. Hope you enjoyed that conversation with Crystal. Unfortunately, that is the last one of the quarterly co-host. And it's the last quarterly co-host of this year. I'd like you to do me a favor and just DM me on LinkedIn or email me, james@rebrandingsafety.com. And let me know whether you're enjoying the quarterly co-host segment. It's something we introduced in Q2 this year. I've actually really enjoyed it. The diversity of the style has been really good. I'd like to get some more, obviously, different styles and stuff. And maybe get a couple more where we interview people like we did with Laura as well. But ultimately, I've quite enjoyed it. We've got some lined up for the new year, but ultimately we do this for you. So let me know what you think. Thank you very much, Paradigm Human Performance, for sponsoring Rebranding Safety podcast and YouTube channel. Don't forget to check them out. Check out the webinar. Everything's linked in the description below. If you're looking for some more help and support, go check out rebrandingsafety.com. There's lots of stuff we can do. And we've just added our consultancy service on there as well. So go check that out. And if you're looking for some support for personal development, then you can come and join Project Meletium, which is a mastermind community for health, safety and risk professionals. But ultimately, thank you very much for listening and watching this podcast. I'll catch you next week. Safe.
The views and opinions expressed in this podcast are those of the host and its guests and do not necessarily reflect the position of the companies. Examples of analysis discussed within this podcast are examples only based on limited and dated open source information and should not be utilised in real life as the only solution available. Assumptions made within this analysis are not reflective of the position of the companies. No part of this podcast may be reproduced, stored, or transmitted in any form or by any means, mechanical, electronic, or otherwise, without prior written permission from James McPherson.